Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Hey, everybody, we got a wonderful one today, and I don't ever say that. I've never said that before. Very often I say we got a great one today for a change. This one is our first wonderful show, and it's Andrew Yang. Andrew Yang, my wonderful guest today. I want to get quickly to a couple of things. These paramilitary troops that Trump is sending to Seattle and to Portland, this is very disturbing, and it's a deliberate provocation and distraction. This has been done before. Nixon did this. Reagan did this at Berkeley when he ran for governor. And sometimes they send in agitators. And this is what I would ask. I would ask that folks that are in Portland or in Seattle or wherever they send these troops, go to the demonstration, take your smartphone, and video the people who seem to, you know, throw a rock or set a fire or something like that, and follow them at the end to their car, if they have a car, and get the license plate. I have a feeling that many of them, or at least some of them, are right-wing agitators trying to give Trump and gang the excuse to do this. And believe me, I know there are anarchists. There are other people who do this for different reasons, and I don't like that. But I would like to know who some of these people are. Okay, speaking of right-wing nuts, I don't know if you saw the video from Marshall, Minnesota. And I love Marshall, Minnesota. It's a great town. But there's a couple went into a Walmart buying food who wore face masks with swastikas on them. And there was, of course, a big argument there. Somebody took a video of it, and it's gone viral. And it's pretty ugly. It's been downloaded millions and millions of times now. And it is. It's pretty ugly.
You have an illness. You can't be American and wear that mask. You cannot. We literally had a war about this. You're wearing a swastika. You literally had a war about this.
The woman, probably the wife, was having an argument. She was wearing a swastika with a few of the people from the store. But if you look at the video, the husband is just checking out the groceries, and someone else took another video. It's the second video, and here it is. I'll play the audio from that.
So, Ginny, are you and your folks going up to the lake?
Yeah, how about you and Marge?
Oh, yeah, we're right up there right now.
Oh, then you might want to stock up on that Bud Light. We got a 2-for-1 sale on them 6-packs.
Oh, gee, well, can I go back there?
Oh, don't be silly. No. Brad, would you go get Mr. Bauer another 6 of the Bud Light?
Well, thanks, Ginny.
Oh, sure. Say, what's that on your mask?
It's a swastika. Oh. Yeah, it was Marge's idea to, you know, to protest the deal about having to wear a mask.
Oh, I think it's a good idea wearing a mask.
Yeah, me too, but, you know, Marge, she watches a lot of Fox, you know.
Yeah, my dad does too, but I don't think he'd wear a, what's that called again?
That's a swastika.
Yeah, and didn't the Nazis wear something like that?
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, that's why my dad probably wouldn't wear one.
Yeah,
Because, you know, his dad fought the Nazis. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, paper or plastic?
All right. Well, there you go. So, we're going to be back with Andrew Yang.
The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Andrew, welcome to my show, and me, welcome to your show, your podcast. Is that right? We're doing a joint.
That's one, right? It's a superhero crossover. I always say that I'm Marvel and the other person's DC, but that's just because I grew up on Marvel.
So now, am I interviewing you? Are you interviewing me? Or this is really just a conversation, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll have precise stopwatches, Al. So if you go to 54% of the time, then I'll just butt in now. But it's phenomenal to meet you and make your acquaintance. I've been a fan of you and your work for decades, not to date you, but back to your SNL days. And seeing your transition into public service was awesome and inspirational.
Well, thanks. And I've been a fan of yours for about, let me see, a year and a half, something like that.
That's when did right. You start? I had zero fans prior to 18 months ago.
And going from having zero fans to entering a field with more than 20 candidates for the Democratic nomination and staying in as long as you did. And getting down to, what was it down to, about five of you or six of you?
Yeah, I think there were maybe six or seven of us. But thank you, Al. Yeah, I outlasted a lot of other people on the island. It was like a strange game of political survivor. I managed to outlast a lot of elected representatives and hopefully showed people a different approach to politics that I hope is here to stay.
I have a theory of why you did so well.
Clean. I would love, because you're like a freaking guru and deep thinker on this. So why did I do so well?
Okay, I'll tell you. Because you're the only human being on the stage. And let me explain what I mean by that. I've been a politician, obviously. I was a senator. And when you have these debates, especially when there would be 10 people on the stage, right? And
oh, I remember.
Yeah. And every one of them has a political consultant who would jam talking points into their head. And because there are 10 people on stage, they could only give you a minute to answer. So what I saw was every one of these candidates had been drilled and had about a minute and a half of talking points for each question. And then went as fast as they could in the minute, went over at least 10 seconds, and then were told to stop
And then went another 10 seconds or 15 until they were stopped. And it was exhausting to listen to. And you just answered the damn question. And I saw that over and over again. And as a result, everyone went, oh, I like him. He's listening. First of all, he's listening. So you're reacting to what other people said in a different way. Am I wrong about this? Is this the first you've heard this analysis?
You are not wrong, Al. And I have to say, it was a very, very strange setting to get used to. I never did get used to it, really. Where, but my first debate was probably well below professional grade, because I said, like, what's to prepare for? They ask you a question, you answer it, like, should be all right. So I agree with you that if you become too consultantified, like, it kind of shows through. And in my case, you know, what was funny is, like, we did eventually hire someone to try and help optimize for the debate. But what they said to me was essentially, like, how would you answer this question? And then tried to just frame everything. Instead of trying to jam talking points into my head, they were trying to just be like, what is your answer here?
Yeah, you were present in a different way than I felt the others were, because you went up there and you were present for the questions. You weren't going through your brain thinking about the answer that you had prepared, it seemed to me, at least at the beginning.
Well, I mean, that's the truth of it, really. And not to say, like, eventually there were things that, you know, I obviously prepared, but I think that my presentness or my experience of the debate itself was somewhat different, where, you know, there's like a humanity, I think, that I just couldn't shake. And there was a period when people were like, yo, like, stop being so human. like it's like, you know, because I had to, like, a consultant. And then they actually gave up at a certain point, Al. So it's pretty funny you picked up on that.
That's what people were responding to, really. Because actually you were present in a different way. You remember how badly Obama did in his first debate in 2012.
Yeah, against Romney. Right? I remember that.
Yeah, it was a terrible performance. And there was some analysis of that, and we heard some of the backstory. In 14, he gave me a call the night before my first debate, not because he knew it was my first debate, just to see how things were going. I said, well, I can't believe it when I'm incredibly nervous. I wasn't nervous the first time I ran in 08. I said, I'm incredibly nervous because it seems like a play. You have to learn lines for a play. And I said, yeah. And I think he almost did terribly in that first debate as a message to his team, which is stop it. At any rate, that humanity that came through, that your consultants couldn't tamp down, came very through. And I think that it's good to be liked. It's a theory I have.
you're describing it as a play. Is so spot on, in part because I remember distinctly, I was walking around, I came back from the bathroom, like during a bathroom break in one of the debates, and one of the other candidates was there literally, like, practicing their clothes like it was a high school play, because I was in a high school play. We were practicing the lines. And then you walk by and you see, like, this candidate, like, literally gesticulating and practicing their closing, and I'm just like, am I back in a high school like play?
And who was that? Who was that?
Oh gosh, I'd feel terrible. Just like, you know, one reason why maybe people like me is I try not to be an asshole. So, like, I'll leave that candidate to people's imagination. If you guess that person, it's probably that person.
I think people know a little bit about you. I think what they knew was that you're some kind of entrepreneur, and that I think that's what they knew. And they didn't know whether you're a tech entrepreneur. And so I did some preparation for this, as I sometimes do. And you seem like to be an entrepreneur. And that's not how you started, right, as an entrepreneur. First, you're a lawyer. You're a lawyer, right? You went to law school, right?
Yes, I have that distinction.
And you were, by the way, editor of Law Review at Columbia, right?
Yes.
Okay, that's a big deal. You're a very learned, very good law student, And how long did you last in the law?
5 whole months, Al.
Okay. What about being a lawyer didn't you like? You were in a law firm, I take it.
Yes, I was at a very fine law firm in New York City, Davis Polk & Wardwell. There were a couple things. I mean, the main thing was that the work itself just seemed so negative, where in order to be a good contract lawyer, you had to think of just the worst things you can imagine happening and try and protect your client against those things. And I was like, am I really going to spend my 20s just trying to think of like the worst things I can think of? is that really how I'm going to spend these years? But bigger picture, a lot of that work was essentially as like grease on a wheel for a big corporate transaction. Sure. We were just like a transaction cost. And so I thought to myself, well, I want to actually build something, and this seems like it's going to train me to do something very different from that. So I should probably leave as soon as possible. If I stayed there, I was going to become a person who is better at that job. You know, because like we're human beings, we change, we adapt. And so when as soon as I realized that I did not want to become good at that job, I was like, I needed to find a different line of work.
How did your parents feel about that? Because they obviously, let me get a little bit of the background, because I think that to a lot of people, you are Asian. Is that fair to say? Yeah. And they went like,
people are Asian. That also means my parents are likely Asian.
Yeah, I think they assume that because Americans are smart. Anyway, so your parents came from Taiwan, right?
Yeah, they met as students at UC Berkeley out west.
Oh, wow. Okay. But they grew up in Taiwan?
Yeah, they both immigrated here in the 60s as students.
As students, I see. So they met at Berkeley. Okay. What did they do? What are your folks do?
My father got his PhD in physics at Berkeley and became a physicist at GE and IBM, where he generated 69 U.S. patents. And then my mom worked as the administrator of computer services at a state university in New York campus near where I grew up.
Boy, that sounds very unusual for Asians.
Yeah, it's very counter to stereotypes. So their reaction when I left the law was not positive, because they came here and they said, well, okay, let's hunker down and tell our kids to do well in school. And like, oh, this one went to law school. That's pretty good. And then it's like, he quit the job. Like, what's going on here? So they try their best to not be too negative towards me. So they just sort of left me alone for a while. That was their approach.
Okay. So then you became an entrepreneur. Is that fair to say?
Yes. I started a business that did not fare well.
It was like a startup or something?
Yeah. It was a .com company called Stargiving.com. You'll love this, Al. It was meant to marry together celebrity philanthropy and the internet. So the thought was that someone like you, Al, would support a children's organization, let's say. You would donate a meet and greet with yourself, and then people would click on the button to support you. They'd be shown advertisers who then give to your organization, and then one of them gets to meet you. So it's like a celebrity philanthropy of the future. So it was stargiving.com, changing the world one click at a time. It was a very .com 1.0 idea, though some version of it now exists today. And I had no business starting this business because I was a 25-year-old lawyer who didn't know anyone. So like I just like ran around trying to put the pieces together to this business that I thought was going to revolutionize philanthropy and change the world, which it did none of those things.
It's an interesting instinct. So right away, your instinct as an entrepreneur was to help philanthropy.
Well, the way I'm wired, Al, is I really like to try and make things work better. And so to me, on this one, you had very inefficient fundraising practices. If you're a well-known person at that time, you would show up to a benefit and maybe someone would auction off a meeting with you. And so I thought, well, if you're going to give away time with yourself, you can generate much more money and attention and awareness if you use the internet. And so let's try and make that work better. Inefficiencies really bother me. They bother me enough so that sometimes I quit my job and try and solve them.
But I love that instinct, and that instinct seems to inform, if that's the right word, pretty much everything you do. Right now, that's post your presidential run. That's a lot of what you do, right?
Yeah, we're distributing money to people. We're up to about 7 million or so in direct economic relief. And we're doing it over PayPal, Venmo, Cash App in increments of between $250 and $1,000. And the thought is that originally I thought like, well, we just need to get people this money. But I also thought this could help inspire our government to approach things more actively and in a better, more accessible way than, for example, having people stay on hold for hours or days trying to access unemployment benefits or rely upon the IRS as a means of distributing checks to people. We have economic relief going. I'm supporting local candidates just like you. And I love your work where you're trying to elevate Sarah Gideon and other candidates because we need to win races around the country. So I'm supporting candidates who have the right vision and values. So what we're trying to further the goals of my campaign, even now through Humanity Forward. And hopefully that's a self-explanatory name as to what we're about.
Yeah, it basically, though, is counter Ted Cruz's organization, Humanity Backward, which has been unfortunately very successful.
Well, you know, I challenged Ted Cruz to go to basketball online, and he said yes, and then he just ducked me. Apparently, he thought better of it, and I'm still bent out of shape about it.
That is so uncharacteristic of him.
Yeah, he's ordinarily such a stand-up, forthright fellow.
Yeah. Okay, we'll be right back with Andrew Yang after this message.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
We're back with Andrew Yang. So all of this kind of ties in to your signature issue during the campaign, universal basic income. And I want to ask you sort of, and maybe have a discussion about the future of work, because I think universal basic income and the future of work dovetail very much so. Is that correct?
Yeah, completely agree.
Let's just refresh people. I'll let you tell people what universal basic income is.
I would love to, but I'd also love to just fill in very, very quickly what happened after my company failed in my 20s. Like you said, Al, most people think of me as like entrepreneur. And then there were a couple of words that got put in front of that, which were Asian and tech. It was like Asian tech entrepreneur. I can't tell you how many times too where people would be like, "You're from California," and I'd be like, "No, but it's fine." You know? So after my .com flopped, I worked at another tech company that also did not succeed. And then I became the head of an education company that grew to become number one in the country and was bought by a national, you know, a public company in 2004. And so this is where you talk about my becoming an entrepreneur comes in. So after my company gets bought in 2009, I leave to start a nonprofit called Venture for America that recruits and trains enterprising college grads to work in startup companies and growth businesses in Detroit, New Orleans, Baltimore, Cleveland, St. Louis, and other cities around the country, with a goal of both cultivating the next generation of entrepreneur and creating jobs in communities that could use a boost. And so I ran that nonprofit for 6 years, and it is during my time in Ohio and Missouri and Michigan and Louisiana and other places that I realized that we were automating away the most common jobs in our country. In my mind, that automation wave led to Donald Trump's victory in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. And I was staring at it myself between the years, 2011 and 2017. And so that's what drove me to run for president. So that was the entire meta entrepreneur org you're talking about, Venture for America, which I'm incredibly proud of. It's kicking butt to this day. It turns out they didn't need me around. But that was the bulk of the exposure I got that led me to run.
So that gets us again to the nexus of the future of work, because no matter how much we increase manufacturing, the jobs that manufacturing creates, there's so much automation. There's so many advances in that and in AI. We're going to be replacing a lot of jobs. And that means that there are going to be people without jobs.
Yeah, it's already happening. And you can see it. It was happening pre-COVID, but now it's speeding up, because a lot of these firms are doubling down on self-checkout or aisle cleaning robots or self-driving vehicles that deliver things and on and on and on. It's real. It's here now. It's no longer speculative or future facing.
Yeah. And as you say, it's been accelerated by COVID. And when we, again, COVID has sort of laid bare a lot of our society's weaknesses, a lot of America's weaknesses. One of them is going to be that a lot of these people who aren't working are not going to have a job when they come back. And we have to be able to do something now. And what happens when, God willing, this damn thing ends?
Yeah, as the numbers guy, the scope of the carnage in our labor market cannot be overstated. You're looking at 30 to 40 million jobs lost, and economists estimate that 42% of those jobs are gone for good. So let's say that number is around 17 million. For reference, the peak of job loss in the Great Recession, which took us a decade to dig out from, was about half that, about 8.8 million. So you're looking at an optimistic case of 2 times the job loss of the Great Recession in perpetuity. And that's assuming that you get 58% of these jobs back, which strikes me as possible. But, even if it were to happen, it would take time. So we're in an historic crisis mode when it comes to job loss. And as human beings, unfortunately, we're not infinitely resilient, where if you stick us in our homes without jobs for a particular period of time, eventually we begin to atrophy and drop out of the workforce in various ways, in various numbers. So that is the situation we're facing. And we need to take dramatic action in multiple ways to try to reinforce and create jobs and opportunities at every level in communities around the country. And it breaks my heart that for whatever reason, we don't seem to have that urgency. I think Joe has that urgency. And I think after we get Trump out of there, we can start to dig out. The gap even between now and January 2021 is going to be too long for many families.
I mean, this president doesn't seem to be able to engage on pretty much anything. I think that has to do with his personality and his lack of engagement, his lack of intellectual curiosity, and his complete lack of empathy. Obviously, all of that has contributed to the unnecessary suffering that we've seen and the unnecessary job loss that we've seen. We've seen other countries, other developed countries approach this. We've seen actual leadership, and we've seen them encourage people to wear masks and to socially distance, and they have. And we've seen them have testing and contact tracing and isolation, and we see them opening. when we see them getting back. You know, I don't mind having a malignant narcissist. You don't have to necessarily have empathy to be a competent person. But if we had a different malignant narcissist who at least was competent and understood it was in his interest and everyone's interest to tackle this damn thing. But this guy, so all this has been exacerbated. This was a tragedy we would have had anyway. We were always going to have a pandemic, but we didn't have to have an out-of-control pandemic. All of this change in the way people work, that was happening anyway. But it's going to be much, much harder for us to recover from this because of this guy's complete inaction, unwillingness to act.
Yeah, on the manufacturing front, which you talk about, we went from 17 million Americans working in manufacturing in, let's say, like the 80s, 90s period. And then it dropped to 12 million over the last number of years. That 5 million is significant. And a lot of those jobs were lost from Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, like those vicinities. Now, of the 12 million that remain, you're looking at progressively automating more and more of it. When policymakers look at it, you have to face facts and it's like, well, you're not going to go from 12 to 17 million again because just we don't make things the same way. You might even consider yourself fortunate to stay around the same 12 million level, given that we're now automating meatpacking plants. We're automating everything we can automate because the fewer humans you have indoors in those sorts of settings, like it's not just a cost saver, unfortunately, but at this point, it's a better way to ensure operational continuity and even protect the public health because you don't want lots of people bunched together. So the recipes, and this was my frustration on the trail, is that like a lot of our politicians are very backward looking in terms of the solutions they're offering. And they say, look, you know, we have to strengthen manufacturing, American manufacturing here. And I'm like, I'm for that. But is that really going to restore us to 17 million manufacturing workers? No, like, you know, it's like a holding action. It's like, if you do it well, you might stop the bleeding. And so the question is whether you can actually start to create new pathways for millions of Americans. And we're way behind on this challenge, Al. This has been going on for years and decades. We've been essentially addressing it through happy talk, being like, oh, like, you know, people will adapt, people will reskill, people will learn to code. And it's just been doing so many people a massive disservice. It's one reason why so many people are fed up. In my mind, this is how someone like Donald Trump becomes president, is that people look up and don't really think that we're addressing these issues where they live and work.
You spoke to that during the campaign, and I think that's why you connected. But I hope, the Democrats take the Senate back, and obviously that Biden defeats Trump. Then I hope we start doing the things that you've been talking about. So let's talk about that. What should Biden's agenda be in terms of addressing this, how Americans work?
Well, the first thing to do is to just to get a means of survival into Americans' hands in terms of these unemployment benefits or the direct cash relief, the $1,200 that Americans got in April, that may happen again. We should have a version of that that's essentially recurring and stable so that people can start to rely upon it and know that they'll have it for a certain period of time. It's like a floor. And there are different ways you can structure the floor, but there should be a floor of some kind. The second thing is to try and figure out what your goals are. One of the big problems that has really distorted not just our policy, but our thinking is that we measure economic progress through GDP, stock market prices, and the headline unemployment rate. GDP is not a good measurement for how our economy is faring for families for a multitude of reasons. Stock market, same thing. And you can see right now the stock market's putting up record highs. And the headline unemployment, Al, it takes a little bit of unpacking, but the unemployment rate doesn't show underemployed people, people working multiple jobs, people who can't afford to make ends meet even if they do officially have a job, or people who are leaving the workforce which has been more and more Americans over time. So after you set a floor for people, the second thing you have to do is you have to set better measurements and real goals. So what might those measurements be? Obvious ones would be health and life expectancy, income and affordability. And again, one reason why people are upset is that you can't afford healthcare or childcare or housing. And so you have those as actual measurements of your economic health, as opposed to how Amazon stock is doing.
All of those, childcare, healthcare,
environmental sustainability.
Yeah, and all of which have been under attack under this president and under Republicans in Congress. I mean, they've been literally under attack. How can you be against family leave? How can you be against sick leave? How can you be against providing Americans with some of the same flexibilities that every other developed country have?
This is one reason why changing the measurements is so important, Al, is because what's happened, unfortunately, is that, let's say family leave, which obviously it's ridiculous that it's like us, Djibouti and like maybe one other country at this point. I mean, it's totally ridiculous. What we've been caught in is this unfortunate tug of war where Republicans mistakenly think that certain things are quote unquote bad for business. And so what we have to do is we have to line things up and say, essentially, what's good for people is good for business, or what's good for people is good for the economy. Because if we get stuck in a tug of war, then it winds up distorting our thinking. It makes it also like harder to argue with Republicans who are just like jobs, jobs, jobs. And like a lot of Americans just respond to that. And so you have to actually show people that, look, doing these things for us actually is good for business, good for the economy, and that you try and get off of this tug of war that is really, it's causing many people to be confused about what would actually help move the economy forward.
I mean, we would have, like, I was on health, education, labor, and pensions. So we would have all these American corporations that were also overseas. And they would say, every other place we are, you have family leave. Every other place we are, they have child care. I mean, I talked with the ambassador from Norway to the United States recently. They give you family leave. You a parental leave for a year. You get a year of that you divide between the husband and wife or the parents.
Yeah, very smart. Yeah, between partners, sure.
Yeah. But then the kid's a year old at the end of a year, by my calculations. And then they have daycare for those kids till they're six. They don't have kindergarten. They have daycare. But guess what? The people who do the daycare, those professionals, they're educated in that, in early childhood development. I hate to say this, but it's easier to live in other countries than here. A lot easier.
My parents, my mom, had to leave here because of COVID. And where she is, she's free as a bird. They're just hanging out. Everything's cool. Like, you know, that like none of the COVID precautions are necessary anymore because they've completely got it under wraps.
Where is that, if you can?
That's Taiwan.
So they did what you need to do.
Yeah, they got after it in a big way. And they monitor things closely. Where we're well past that point now, obviously. I mean, we're essentially at like mitigating community spread. It's a nightmare.
And who would you blame for that? Who would you blame for that?
Certainly President Trump is at the head of the class where, you know, if you had better leadership, you'd have a better shot. But we had bureaucratic failures at every level, Al, and it pains me. I mean, the ones that we know about in the CDC are infuriating. You know, it's like your first test is contaminated, so it's useless. And so you lose a month of testing in the most crucial period. And then when people are landing from these places, like local authorities are like, hey, what do I do? Like, can't test them. And the CDC is like, oh, just let them go. Like, what are you going to do? You know, I mean, that was like the crucial time period. You had local authorities saying the CDC, like, look, should we be suspending some of like these flights, or should we be processing people who are coming in differently? Or like, what do we need to be doing? And you just had essentially the Keystone Cops over there. And that is not on Trump. I mean, Trump has his own like lion's share of the blame, rightfully so. But there wasn't exactly like a whole, you know, set of role models executing at high levels at other parts of the government. And then it gets pushed out to the states, and then you have like all sorts of individual decisions. The thing that I think about the most, Alan, you know, it's very, very important that you have clear communications from leadership saying, look, wear a mask, take precautions. But what I think about is who is actually doing the processing of the person who's landing on an airplane in the airport and then instructing that they self-quarantine, following up on them, tracing contacts if they are positive, like who have they been in touch with. But, you know, that's a lot of labor. You know, I'm an entrepreneur, and so I think about who's actually going to execute on the ground level, because you can come up with shit in the boardroom and it doesn't matter. Like, you know, the boardroom matters, but it's like if no one's actually following that person around and figuring out, or at minimum calling into them, then it's not going to work. And to me, that's like the massive gap. If you take testing off the table in the early days and you don't have personnel available to trace contacts, that's how you wind up in our situation. And that would be true even if your communication was better.
3 months ago, Andy Slavitt, who was head of CMS under Obama for the last couple of years, and Scott Gottlieb, who was head of FDA under Trump, put together a contact tracing and isolation regime, 180,000 additional people doing contact tracing. Why we didn't implement it at the beginning is just beyond me.
Yeah,
just beyond me. I mean, we should be putting more toward testing and tracing and contact tracing. That's what we should be doing. You do it as soon as you can. The time the planet tree is today. They should have been doing it right away. They didn't, because this president paid absolutely no attention and wanted for 6 weeks to 2 months to pretend that it wasn't happening when he was being told it was. And of course, because this guy cannot admit making a mistake, he's invested in continuing the failed approach.
Yeah, it's disgusting, and it can't change soon enough. Like the next administration, the Biden administration, and I am optimistic that Joe's going to win, in part because 72% of Americans believe that right now is the worst time they've ever lived, which does not seem to me to be a very pro-incumbent point of view. So let's imagine that Joe wins. Some of your friends are in the Senate, and we even have a majority. And to me, like, the big questions are, like, what the heck do we do to try and get us on better footing? And we genuinely need a new deal, or a relaunch America plan that has at its core job creation. The goal should be job creation while achieving goals that we have left untended for far too long. So what does that list look like? Certainly right now it would center around fighting COVID and contact tracing. Infrastructure should be front and center. We have crumbling bridges, roads, schools, you name it, like, you know, no broadband in rural parts of the country, that I think our last grade was something like a D+ in terms of our infrastructure, and that we could spend $4 to $5 trillion just trying to get ourselves up to a B. And if we did that, which we should 100% do, we would get that money back and then some, just in having functional roads and bridges and the rest of it. And we'd create hundreds of thousands, even millions of jobs, because there's a lot of work to do. And you could build environmental sustainability into that infrastructure project, which we should. So you can imagine an army of Americans getting put back to work, installing solar panels or upgrading out-of-date buildings. So this is the opportunity that I believe exists under the new administration, but it should be centered around how we can create millions of jobs, because we're going to need them.
I've been saying that when your opponent is digging himself a hole, like Trump has been, basically the rule is let him dig. But I feel that Biden right now is getting to the point where he has to tell people this is what he's going to do. And I think that all the things, I mean, obviously infrastructure is something that Americans want, roads and bridges and tunnels and railroads and airports and schools that at least resemble the rest of the developed world, you know?
Yeah.
And they want every kid to have broadband. I mean, that's one of the things that that we've seen during COVID, one of the things that's been laid bare. These kids, I mean, you can't learn virtually if you don't have the internet.
I'll tell you another story. This sounds like I'm just pumping up Taiwan. but when I was in Taiwan last, which was several years ago, I rode a train that went the equivalent of the distance between New York and DC in like an hour and 25 minutes. And it was mind blowing. It led to enormous economic development because you could be something like 80 miles away from downtown Taipei, and it was commute length. And so you had like a whole different community rise. And then you come back to the States and you're like, why is it that other countries can solve some of these problems and we can't? So that is the, to me, that should be the goal, is to try and show that we're actually competitive in the 21st century in terms of a world-class infrastructure.
And Taiwan is not alone here at all. Japan and Germany and France and Italy all have high-speed rail.
Yeah, it's not alone at all.
No, you know, we used to be the indispensable nation. And Americans used to pride themselves, we're the indispensable nation. You know, during Ebola, and some of this is, I believe, at Trump's feet, because 80% of the funding for CDC, for its overseas presence, to monitor this kind of thing, he cut for like 37 countries, including in China. And he got rid of the pandemic office within the National Security Council. This falls a great deal to him. In Ebola, it's a global effort that we led. But here, he just said, okay, it's the governors. It's as if after Pearl Harbor, FDR, instead of saying, you know, we're going to war, he just said, you know what? This is kind of Hawaii's problem.
We're like the pitiable basket case of the world at this point, in terms of our approach to this. Instead of leading the world in responding to COVID, we're like the country that the rest of the world is feeling bad for.
I don't think they felt that way during Obama. I mean, believe me, there were a lot of things that went unattended to, partially because the Republicans took over the House in 2010, that election, and then in 2014, the Senate. And, you know, and of course, they Republicans were saying, like, well, we don't want deficits. that's going to kill us, those deficits. And then as soon as they get in, boom, they pass a tax cut that goes to those at the top that adds $1 trillion to the deficit. And look at the cost of this. Look at the cost of inaction here.
Al, I'm curious what your future may hold. So obviously, you know, I knew about you as a senator, and you have this podcast, which is very fun and exciting. I'm with you, obviously, in the universe of being a podcast host. But I know you're very passionate about these causes and the need to make big changes. And I know, like me, you're trying to help local candidates, but I'd love to hear more about some of the work you're doing. And maybe if you'd like, if you want to pump up a couple of the candidates that you have your eye on as people that could become big difference makers.
Well, we have to take the Senate back. I mean, if you want to go there first, I mean, obviously, you know, Steve Bullock in Montana, I think has a very good chance.
Sure, I met him on the trail.
That's right. And I kind of wish that Perez had let him in those debates, because what he did was he paid attention to Montana as governor, and he wanted to get Medicaid expansion.
Yeah, no, authorized being a responsible leader there, and he ended up, you know, with a late start as a result. You shouldn't punish someone for doing a great job at their actual job.
No, and I thought that was, there's no perfect way to do this, but I thought that was a big, big, big mistake, because I thought he was a great candidate. No offense to you.
None taken. If you made a short list of folks, and we can have some fun with this, Al, but if you made a short list of folks who I thought did not get their due during the race, Steve Bullock would be either at or very near the top.
Yeah, well, and that's kind of why I bring it. Also, I just really don't like Danes. So Steve Bullock is someone I would urge my listeners and your listeners to give to. We know where those races are. They're in North Carolina. They're in Maine. They're in South Carolina. It's Colorado. It's Arizona. It's North Carolina.
Hickenlooper, another former candidate.
Yeah. As soon as Hickenlooper dropped out, he went riding in the Senate race, and I'm glad. I'm happy. Because Cory Gardner, you know, I was on energy with him, and he was a cipher. I'm sorry to say so. As a human being, I'm sure he's more than that. Also, every chance I get, and so for your audience, for your listeners, get trained to be a poll worker. Basically, most poll workers are older, are above 60. We're going to need younger people being poll workers because otherwise the line, they will not have enough polling places and their lines will be long, and that's what they want to do. They want to suppress the vote.
Yes.
So I tell my listeners this all the time. Mark Elias, who's the lead election lawyer for Democrats, says it's the number one thing people can do is get trained as a poll worker.
I love it. It's concrete. It's practical. It'll have an immense impact.
Exactly.
And I love how you're focused on these Senate races, in part because you know a lot of the folks on both sides. So, you know, if you've spent time and worked with someone, you can be like, oh, that person has to go. Or I love that person and I would love for them to win. Or it could be like, I love these people and I want that person to join them in the Senate. I mean, it's a unique perspective that, you know, you're one of a very small handful of people that can actually approach it that way.
There are some people on my side that I don't love, but that's neither here nor there. The point is that for my kids' sake and my grandchildren's sake, we have to take the Senate back. And all these enablers, it's every one of them. It's every one of those Republicans who bought this. And believe me, when Trump got elected, my Republican colleagues in the Senate were shocked. And to a person, except for Sessions at the time, just before he became AG, the reason they couldn't believe it is they knew how unqualified this guy was. And they said so. They said so out loud in private. And I know every one of them has enabled this guy. And so every one of them should go.
Yeah, there was a real capitulation on that side. And
really?
It's very, very sad.
Yeah, it's been extremely sad. We can go on and on, but they've made their bed. They really have. There's no, you know, the Republican base is 80% at least for Trump.
As you can tell, I'm optimistic Joe wins. I love your focus on the Senate races because Joe will have a much harder time getting what he needs to get done without a Senate majority. And it is a very interesting thought exercise, not to get ahead of ourselves, but to imagine what Republicans do after Trump is gone. You know, like there is a sense that maybe things will, I think obviously things will improve. I don't disagree with you that folks that caved to Trump within the party have lost something that's very hard to get back. So one of my frustrations, and, you know, I know you're obviously like a fervent Democrat, Al, is that we have this two-party duopoly that's really, really not doing well. Like, you saw the Republican Party get taken over by Trump, and then you're left with these people that have become his, like, yes men and women. And you're just like, oh, what are you doing? And it is an open question what the heck the future of that party looks like post-Trump.
It is. Well, I think what we need to be talking about now, anyway, is what Joe and Democrats want to do. If we get the majority in the Senate, I think it's just inevitable that the filibuster goes away. And the American people want, right now, they do nothing, nothing. I mean, it's unbelievable as we speak, they are still haven't put together a relief package for COVID. The House did it in May,
yeah,
May 15th. So they still haven't done this, which is insane. And they do nothing but confirm these Federalist Society judges. And nothing will get done if McConnell can filibuster everything. I've seen that. That's what he did.
You know, I had a conversation with Michael Bennett from Colorado. We were talking about his frustrations the same way. He was like, you know, we were like, hey, I'm running for president. He was like, yeah, because like I just felt like I couldn't get anything done in the Senate. So let's say Joe does win. There's a majority in the Senate that he's working with. I loved his announcement about fighting climate change and moving us toward green energy and renewable energy. I do think that Joe believes we need very big changes coming out of this. It would be interesting as to whether it would be better for him to start announcing what some of those changes would look like now, or just stick with like what seems to be a working approach or strategy.
He absolutely has to say what he's for. The president had this interview with Sean Hannity, and Sean Hannity asked him what his goals were.
Oh, gosh, that was so bad. His goals were completely incoherent.
Well, he had none. But what's amazing is you could have no goals and still be incoherent about the no goals. But Biden has to answer that question. And the good news is that the things Biden and you and I are for, the American people are for. They are for infrastructure. They are for building on Obamacare, not tearing down Obamacare. They are for having a positive presence in the world and not embracing Kim Jong-un and Erdogan.
We have a lot on our plate, and it's going to need all of us, and we just got to try and get some of these freaking candidates across the finish line. So you've got my support on that. If there are any races that you want me to try and help with, feel free to ping me. Like Steve, I'm a fan of, you know, I like Hick. Like I just sent something out supporting Sarah Gideon in Maine. So anything I can do to help, because it is all hands on deck. I mean, the country's burning.
Absolutely. And I've been a fan and admirer of yours, not for decades, but for about a year and a half.
Well, thank you. One of the things I'm happiest with, Al, is that the entire process of running for president was so uncomfortable. And it was uncomfortable in part because everyone's always asking you questions about like the most serious things under the sun. I'm just glad that I managed to like actually inject a little bit of humor and levity and humanity because it wasn't easy. Like it was like pulling teeth because everywhere I went, people were always like, you know, like just so serious. It made me want to jump out a window so often.
But you get to campaign, you get to meet the American people. I love campaigning, but I love more going around my state and hearing what people wanted and needed.
Campaigning was great. Media questions about things that were like marginal to what most people like cared about. It's like, but talking to people, oh yeah, I'm with you. Like that's something that's very moving. And you know, the fact that people supported me the way they did, I mean, you just never forget it, you know? It's like, it's just with you.
No, it's amazing. It's a blessing to be able to do that. And it's amazing that you, when that field started at, it was above 20, and that you were, you know, passing senators and other longtime office holders, and people just responded, and they'll keep responding to you, and let's do stuff together, okay?
Yeah, would love that too, Al. Thank you for this.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now. now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.